This is Lekka. I'm Lucy Dearlove. This is Out of the Box.
We reverse engineered the bottle, like designing it from the cap outwards.
Do not destroy this carton when empty. Put it with other waste paper and cardboard for the salvage collectors.
The next time you get a delivery, we'll pick up your empty tin and we'll swap it out with the full one.
I don't even need my name, my face in people's kitchens. I just want them to remember the taste.
I've been thinking about packaging for a long time. And over the past few months, for paid subscribers on the Lekka Substack and Patreon, I've been talking to different people about it. And I'm sharing some bits taken from those conversations here. If you want to hear the full thing and support the work that I do with Lekka, you can sign up on your preferred platform via the link in the show notes. Paid subscribers help make the work I do with Lekka sustainable and enable me to devote more time to making new episodes. If you enjoy the podcast and you're in a position to spare a few pounds a month, I'd really appreciate any support you're able to give. Find out more in the show notes. Also, I've got an exciting offer for Lekka listeners in London who love to eat delicious food. Keep listening to the end to find out more. Mostly as a result of the predominantly industrialised nature of our food systems, the vast majority of what we eat tends to come to us packaged. This happens for various reasons. Might be because it's processed in some way and needs to have its own container, or because it comes from a long way away and needs to be transported and preserved, or because it's a fragile product that degrades quickly and needs to be packaged in a certain way to avoid food waste. It didn't used to be this way. And there is a specific point when food packaging shifted towards the non-reusable, as you'll hear more about in this episode. So many of the containers and general surroundings of the food we buy are unable to be refilled. Many are entirely disposable, or might as well be for some people, as materials like flexible plastic film, the sort you might get a bag of apples or spinach in, aren't usually recyclable without being taken to a specific collection point. A parliamentary report published in 2017 found that the UK uses 38.5 million plastic bottles every day, of which 15 million are not recycled. The report goes on to say that 700,000 plastic bottles are littered every day, encouraging more littering and causing damage to natural habitats and human well-being. Plastic bottle waste is not simply a recycling or environmental issue, it is a social issue with considerable direct and indirect costs for taxpayers through litter picking and healthcare, it reads. In Oliver Franklin Wallace's book Wasteland, the author draws attention to how this shift from reusable to disposable was coupled with a shift in labelling who was responsible for the packaging. Previously, the packaging had belonged to the company. They needed it back in order to sell more product. But once disposable packaging became the norm, it quickly became the responsibility of the customer, or the eater. Franklin Wallace points out that the UK charity Keep Britain Tidy, whose Tidy Man logo, a stick figure throwing paper into a trash can, adorns most packaging to remind people to dispose of their waste responsibly, he writes, has historically received donations from corporations like Coca-Cola, Nestle, and McDonald's. In other words, those ultimately at the root of the production of this so-called litter. This seems to me like such an unjust burden to put on the consumer, who has no choice about how their food is packaged. The packaging of what we eat tells us so much about the way that we live. The Museum of Brands in West London is a truly fascinating walk back in time, a history of consumer culture through packaging. I met the curator Alice Kane there for a personal tour of their time tunnel, which takes us back through over a century of branded goods via mostly their packaging. It's important to note that the museum is a personal collection, that of Robert Opie, and so it is not necessarily definitive, but it certainly gives a very comprehensive overview.
So the collection starts in sort of mid-Victorian period, and he is really interested in the points of sort of social change, particularly to do with the railways and particularly to do with shopping, and how those two things are reflected in everything that we have in our lives. And then there is obviously, there's brands that we know. Coleman's is here, Cadbury's is here. You know, so it's things that are still around, Bovril. We also find here is some of these containers, obviously, particularly for bottles. Here we've got an example of ginger beer, but the reuse of bottles, the going into circulation, staying in circulation, redistributed, coming back in and out again. We've got that with like these jugs here, these earthenware jugs. These would have contained, sometimes they would have contained chemicals, so for cleaning, and you could have those refilled. Someone would come to your house, refill those.
What's remarkable about the way that the museum is laid out, when you're interested in tracing the history of food packaging, as I have been, is that it's all there. Because the history of packaging is inextricably linked with the history of brands. All of these items can tell us a story, not just about companies and brands and products, but also about materials and systems and habits.
These are really interesting too, these Cross and Blackwell pots here.
So their stoneware as well?
Yeah, so the Cross and Blackwell store in London, they would do all of their jam making and pickling and everything like that on site. So as a customer, you would take back your empties, they'd clean them and refill them for you there and then, all in one place.
What an amazing system.
What a great system. I mean, obviously, you know, not practical anymore, but at the time, all of this stuff was just, you know, really normal and natural, and you wouldn't think twice. And the companies were responsible for those pots and jars and bottles. They had a responsibility for them. So then we go into, obviously, the 1940s, and a really important part of the story of with the packaging. I've titled this kind of change in crisis. And it shows that when things are really bad, brands will step up and change, and you have to. And I feel that I do see a reflection of that now in the environmental crisis. And we can change. It is possible. On a large scale, we can see here all of the ways that the tins haven't got full labels on them. All of the colour has gone for it, really.
Wow. Yeah, the contrast is the remarkable,
contrast
isn't it?
The contrast is huge. You know, just like this little Cross and Blackwell label here is tiny, and they're not using ink. They don't want to use paper. We're being told, bring back your empties.
Yeah, so this is actually a government message here. Your empties wanted, please bring back your empty cod liver and oil and orange juice bottles when you come for any supplies. So,
exactly.
Government messaging around it.
Government messaging around it has changed, and that changes again, like how people are thinking about their packaging. They're thinking, oh, right, I must take this back. I must reuse this. There's always some nice examples, particularly on metal things, of, you know, the metal being needed to, please, you know, don't throw this away.
Of course, yes, of course.
Do not destroy this carton when empty. Put it with other waste paper and cardboard for the salvage collector. So again, I mean,
that's on the box
that's
itself.
Huge,
it's almost
huge
as big as the
box.
Logo.
Absolutely. We've now walked into a whole other world of packaging. 1950s. Oh, how we've forgotten the war at this point. It's bold, colourful, big, bright.
It's oh my God.
So different.
So different. All about
different.
Brands. Look how big the brand names are.
The brands have gone wild. Obviously, we've got this huge change in how people, we've got a nice fridge. This is probably one of the hugest changes. But then, of course, you know, the technology
appliances.
Of the appliances, toasters and blenders and, you know, the cooker is changed. Everything feels different.
And it mentions here the influence from America. I guess that feels very visible here, the kind of like American packaging.
Absolutely.
I guess as a result of our relationship in the war and the allyship there.
Yeah, and I mean, obviously, we've still got examples here of things being reused. So, for example, these yogurt pots here. It says, please return bottle on the yogurt pot. Now, again, we kind of forget that the milkman didn't just deliver milk. The milkman would deliver your eggs, your yogurt, your orange juice, if you want it. You know, the milkman was actually very, very useful for
like
daily
grocery.
Little daily provisions. So, you know, didn't just lose the milk delivery. All these other different things got kind of neglected as well.
But at this point in the 20th century timeline, as told by the products collected by Robert, We've moved firmly away from the idea of rinse, return and reuse. And this is clearly explicitly communicated to consumers.
You can see it more on plastic bottles, but the messaging changes on all the bottles at this period. And things start being specified that there is no return on the bottle. There's no return on the jar. There's no reuse. And that messaging, it starts to become really clear to sort of late 70s and into the 80s.
Yeah.
That you start to see that really big shift in what people are told to do with their rubbish.
So that's really, I hadn't really thought about that aspect of it, but obviously it was a habit that had to be trained out of people. As well as now we're trying to, you know, maybe push towards training it back into people. But yeah, like that's so interesting.
Yeah, exactly. So it's like, it's saying you were doing this, now you're not, and now we're telling you what you are doing.
Yeah.
And then in the 1980s, it shifts into actually you're going to be throwing this away and recycling it rather than just telling you, oh, don't return it back to me.
Yeah.
So you start to see the little logo of recycling starts appearing on things.
Wow, but it should be noted, there were still exceptions to the shift towards disposable packaging.
But there was one brand through the 1980s that we have a little bit of a focus on in the reuse display, and that was Corona. So we can see here.
I've never heard of that.
So Corona had very, it's actually Welsh by origin. It had a very, very strong relationship with reuse. So we'd seen how people would pick up the bottles and refill them. Corona was doing that well into the 1960s. So they had Corona Van Man would come and pick up your empties, give you the money back for your deposit, and then give you the Corona that you wanted.
Wow.
People felt very, very connected with this. They were kind of centred around where the drink was being produced.
Okay, so it was quite a regional...
It was quite a regional thing. And I think people had a very strong relationship with their memories.
Proud, I guess.
Yeah, absolutely. So they actually continued their deposit scheme on their bottles right throughout the 1980s. And they also had the deposit on plastic bottles in the 1980s.
Oh, very interesting.
And it really, the whole system was basically broken down by eventually, like, their people weren't returning things anymore, people weren't using the Corona Man anymore.
Because they'd been trained out of them.
They'd been completely trained out of it. And, you know, other companies come in, they buy things, they think, oh, that's a really expensive way of doing this.
I found it fascinating to see the shift in behaviour dictated to consumers. I really didn't expect that. In Wasteland, Franklin Wallace writes about how in the post-war boom, the burgeoning middle classes were, quote, buried in an avalanche of disposable stuff. This disposable stuff was specifically made from plastic. Empowered by a glut of cheap raw materials, he writes, packaging companies had already begun pumping out single-use versions of almost anything you could buy. Pots and pans, plates, cutlery, towels, dog bowls. Drinks once sold as refills were now packaged in one-way bottles or plastic cups designed to be tossed after one use. And now it's becoming increasingly apparent that another shift needs to happen. We are simply drowning in plastic. A survey published earlier this year found that for every percentage increase in plastic produced, there was an equivalent increase in plastic pollution in the environment. An international team of volunteers collected and surveyed more than 1.8 million items of plastic waste across 84 countries over 5 years. The bulk of the rubbish collected was single-use packaging for food, beverage, and tobacco products. They concluded that fewer than 60 multinationals are responsible for more than half of the world's plastic pollution, with 6 responsible for a quarter of that. So what happens next?
I'm Hugo Lynch. I'm the sustainability leader at Able & Coal. And alongside the rest of my team, we work across the spectrum of everything we do at Able & Coal. And Able & Coal is an organic grocery working online. We're direct to customer, which gives us a kind of unique position in the retail market because we have a little bit more control over packaging in particular. Mm. And we own our own delivery fleet. And that allows us to do a lot of return transit, so backhaul logistics, which is slightly different, well, completely different to how the majority of retailers do their direct-to-customer delivery. So if you do Tesco home delivery, for example, actually Tesco is a bad example, but some supermarkets will outsource the deliveries. When that kind of thing started to become more popular, they really wanted to offer timed delivery slots. Mm. And we have we were kind of sticks in the mud, I guess, and we decided not to offer that to customers. Mm. We wanted to optimize for carbon. It was a decision to say, we don't want to, you know, to do these timed delivery rounds, send the drivers going all over the place, emitting more CO2 from the vans and being just like completely inefficient with the fuel. But as a result, because the drivers go on a round, like a milk round, we're able to collect back the transit packaging that the customers receive the product in. And that's kind of been one of the real selling points of our business model for a really long time. And our customers are really bought into it. And in 2020, we launched a refill product range, Club Zero, which we launched in 2020 about 2 or 3 months before the pandemic hit. So it was,
wow,
it was
timing, interesting.
Well, yes, but we did actually have to stop doing it during the pandemic because we had there were a lot of supply issues, and we actually had a huge amount of increased demand to pack fruit and veg. So that was sort of parked for about a year, and then it was restarted again in 2021, and we started to really put some investment into it at that time, and we've had a lot of growth in that range. Mm-hmm. We've expanded it from just your sort of basic pantry items to include household cleaning, more sort of treat-oriented food. I mean, still mostly dried foods. But once we started transporting the household cleaning products around and liquids, we then launched with a plant-based milk that's from a third party. So that's completely separate to us in a way, but we were able to operate that return logistics for them. And that was kind of the opening to finally do this project with milk, which had been talked about for probably 5 years, to introduce a refill scheme for milk, because customers have always asked us about packaging, and milk is so visible. It's also a very popular product, and also everybody knows what the alternative is.
Yeah,
everybody has experience with a milk round. Even people who are maybe too young to have actually had one know the law, right? They know of it. So I think everybody knows what the concept of it is.
In 1975, 94% of milk was put into glass bottles, according to Dairycrest. By 2012, this was just 4%. Various reasons were attributed to this: cost, weight of glass, the breakability of it as a material. And it's pretty clear that the rise of supermarkets in the 80s and 90s and their decision to sell milk cheaply in plastic bottles had a lot to do with it.
You mentioned that this is a project that has been a long time in the making. So when did it start being something that was being talked about?
It started being talked about in 2019. We ran a trial with a product called EcoLean, which is actually a plastic film, a flexible plastic film. And when we were launching that trial or thinking about doing it, we commissioned a carbon calculator from a consultancy in London called ReLondon. That's been a really useful tool that we've really been using for a lot of our calculations, and cross-referencing with other data. At the time, what we were looking to do was to save carbon and to save plastic. So the concept was that we would pack the milk into these film packages, which
a bag,
basically. Okay. Yeah. Like you'll see it on planes and things like that. The concept was that the bag would be filled, sealed, sent to a customer, and used as a normal milk bottle would be. Mm-hmm. And then they would send the plastic back, and we would send it to the manufacturer to recycle.
Okay.
That was the concept. It kind of fell down in two areas. The first being a very significant change to the bottling process at the dairy. And this actually, I think, is one of the kind of the really key considerations for how we've ended up going in the direction that we have. The really big change there that would have been essentially stripping out the existing bottling plant and putting in a new one to do this. And then the other thing was getting it to the customer required that it be, you know, completely sealed everywhere, which meant that customers had to use a pair of scissors to open it up. And so then we looked into doing perforations on the bag, and once we did that, it started leaking into people's boxes. It just ended up not being something that we were able to proceed with, unfortunately.
Yeah.
But we took a lot of the learnings from that in terms of the carbon savings that we could generate. And we also had modelled some scenarios about bottle reuse. So because obviously, you know, glass has always been one of the things that we were thinking in the back of our minds, can we change to a refillable glass bottle?
Yeah.
But plugging in the data and plugging in the scenarios into our calculator, we found that the plastic would actually deliver those carbon savings significantly faster than the glass ever could.
That's so interesting.
Because of the weight. Yeah, the weight of the packaging was so much heavier, like 5-6 times heavier than the plastic one is. And as a result, you know, once you've factored in the production of both, which obviously is also higher for glass because there's more of it and there's very high processing temperatures for glass, you then have the recycling routes. Glass is really easily recycled, but so is plastic. Plastic bottles are really commonly recycled. It's not a difficult thing to get out there. And once you start to look at those two things together, and this calculator, you know, we can put in all of our delivery miles and all of this kind of stuff. And when we did all of that, we found that the bottle would actually deliver a 50% carbon reduction on the packaging with 4 returns versus glass, which required 15.
God.
And in addition to that, 4 returns felt like something that we could reliably get.
Yeah, 15 is a lot.
Really difficult to do because the customer has to keep coming and buying it.
And glass is breakable.
And it's breakable, exactly. So the glass might not even make it to 15.
Yeah. Wow.
Yeah. So that was our thinking. But then going back to the thing I said about the filling machinery and the kind of logistics inside the dairy, the cost of repurposing that or changing these things, it's in the hundreds of thousands because it's industrial machinery. So to go to glass, it would have cost £300,000 or £400,000 in equipment, setting up the whole thing again, the bottling plant. And the mainly that would be to do with the capping technology, the way it's handled on the belt and all of these kinds of things.
Yeah,
plus buying a cleaning, like a washing machine for the bottles. So all of that kind of compounds to make something that is not actually a very attractive proposition to customers or who are used to paying. Our milk costs about £1.50, which, you know, that's probably, you know, one of the things that we sell that's like most price competitive with bigger retailers. And, you know, customers really appreciate that. We want to keep it at that price point.
Yeah.
We don't want people to be, you know, having to pay an extortionate amount for a product that we believe is a lot better than what they would get elsewhere.
Yeah.
So we were looking at how we could keep the cost down as well. And there was all of these things factored in together. It's not like I'm kind of painting it as if it was like step by step, but they kind of all converged together. And so we saw, you know, we can make this carbon saving straight to, you know, really quickly with the plastic, and we actually might be able to do it. Like, we actually might be able to get it back that many times, and the price of it would not increase. We can use the existing resources that are there. So our bottle uses the same cap as they were using on the old bottle. So we reverse engineered the bottle, like designing it from the cap outwards, and it also fits into the same milk crates. So there's very little about our distribution system that has changed in going to this.
Yeah.
But we invested, obviously, in a washing machine. And even then, we did receive some support from Innovate UK to be able to do that, because the cost of all of these things still adds up. And that's kind of what's allowed us to launch it at the price point. So we kept the price point exactly the same. And as far as we know, we are the first we're definitely the first in the UK to be doing this, but possibly, dare I say, the world, to be doing it in this way and not asking for a deposit. We don't really track the bottles. We just ask customers to return them. And the compliance has been really good. So we're very happy with that, with how it's gone.
And like outside of the compliance, what has other feedback from customers been like?
So mostly positive, overwhelmingly positive. But there are some, and I think this is, again, a very thorny subject area, the use of plastic. People are quite concerned about. That's been one of the things that really slowed down the project. That's why it's taken so long to achieve, because we had to go through so many validation stages to prove that, A, we could even wash it to a suitable standard. And to be able to prove that, we had to make the machine first. So you have to make the washing machine, put the bottles in the machine, and then they get washed to a standard that there's then considered clean enough to use. microbiologically. And then you also have to factor in the leaching out of plastic material, of chemicals, which is something that we've tested extensively as well, following the, you know, the guidance from the European Commission against what's called like controlled substances. But yeah, there are a lot of obstacles to doing it this way. We're really happy with how it's turned out. And I think what it's demonstrated to the wider industry is that in order to do something at this scale, and it kind of has to be at this scale to be successful, but our calculations showed that, you know, just as a really rough estimate, the dairy industry making this switch on a wider scale would save about 300,000 tons of carbon a year. God. With just the full returns that we'd factored in. So it's something that we're really trying to push the industry to replicate. What's clear is that you can get a certain number of people excited about buying all of their household essentials in refillable packaging, but you need to kind of get everybody, and in order to get everybody, you need to try out lots of different products. And that's why milk was so transformational for us, because it took us from maybe like 3,000 or 4,000 orders a week in Club Zero for the whole range of over 100 products, to now over 13,000 orders a week of
wow,
milk.
Wow, okay.
Just the milk. And that's a refill product. So that's now reaching about 30% of our customers.
Wow.
So it's a huge yeah. step change. And that's kind of what we're trying to
That's wild.
Achieve. Yeah, yeah.
Over the past few years, the amount of takeaway food we consume as a nation has risen dramatically. It went up during lockdown, particularly, and then, according to research, never really went back down again. Takeaway packaging is really interesting and absolutely crucial to the whole system of food for takeaway and delivery. It needs to be durable enough and protective enough for drivers and riders to transport it to us, but it also needs to be cheap enough that retailers can buy hundreds and thousands of units without increasing their prices so much that the customer is put off. To take one example, the history of the pizza box as we know it today goes back to about the 1960s, when the first patent was filed for a folding pizza box made out of corrugated fiberboard, which protected the pizza and helped keep it hot. Tom Monahan, the founder of Domino's, is quoted as saying that the corrugated pizza box was one of the key innovations responsible for building the success of the Domino's pizza delivery system. Interestingly, Deliveroo now actually have their own packaging store in partnership with Biopack, the self-described market leaders in eco-friendly packaging. Much takeaway packaging is made of more sustainable material than it used to be. Thankfully, polystyrene tubs are mostly a thing of the past, but I'm still often racked with guilt at the sight of multiple plastic tubs after a takeaway. I reuse as much as I can and recycle anything I can't, but it still doesn't feel great.
So dubba quite literally means box. And in this version, it is a tiered, stacked box classed together with clips, essentially.
East London's Dabba Drop was founded in 2018 by Renee and Anshu, who wanted to offer something different on the takeaway market.
So for anyone who wants to sign up, they can go on our website and they can choose between either getting a delivery every week or every fortnight. There's one menu that's cooked every week at the moment, but soon we're looking to have a bit of variety in the menu, so you'll be able to choose between two different menus. Then on the week of your delivery, you'll get an email and the cyclist time, the delivery window, and then it will all be delivered, basically. So yeah, each of our dubbers has four different stacks, four different tins within it. The bottom one is generally rice. Then we usually have a dal, a vegetable curry, and a sort of a more dry stir fry vegetable dish on the top. And then you can choose between samosas and various other pickles and chutneys as sides as well, if you want to sort of pimp your dabber up.
Everybody eats the same thing, which is, in the early days, we sort of went with that because, to make it operationally easy for ourselves. But that now that everyone, across London, this week, for example, there's just under 2,000 people eating with us. Everybody's eating the same thing, So it is kind of quite a lovely communal feeling. It's something that started in our community, but now
everyone's kind of welcome around or eating with us together, you know. And Renee ate her dabba last night, I'm going to eat mine tonight. So, you know, there's that community, which is something in modern day sort of big cities you lack. So we wanted to bring that back and, you know, simpler times, taking a pause from your life, sitting down, opening up your dabba and, you know, eating together. That's where it all comes from as well.
And because we always know exactly how many people we're feeding every week, there's no food waste as well, which is right. Obviously...
very important part of the model.
Yeah. Yeah, okay.
And sorry, I forgot to mention, you know, how does it work in terms of the dabba being swapped out? So it's obviously a subscription model, which means that the next time you get a delivery, we'll pick up your empty tin and we'll swap it out with the full one. So it's a circle of good. And then the empty ones come back to base, we wash and sterilise them and they get prepped up for the next week's menu.
One of Dabba Drop's problems is that their packaging is actually too good. Do you feel like there might be loads of like stray dabbers out there that where people have meant to order again and they... obviously it hasn't been picked up. Is that something that preys on your mind?
It does. Our goals for the next year or so is to try and find a way of tracing the dabbers, because we don't, it's not built into the system yet, and we don't, there isn't a program for us to be able to kind of scan a dabber in to our building and scan it out.
Yeah, we'd have to sort of remake the dabba tins with an RFID chip or something, which is obviously expensive, and we already have so many dabbers in circulation. So we're working on that.
Yeah.
It's called Project Trace.
Yeah.
Maybe you need an amnesty.
Well, we do. Every now and again, we obviously send out emails to our database and just say, hey, look, have you got any kicking around? We'll come and pick them up or whatever. And yeah, we get an influx back to the kitchen.
Yes. Yeah, because it's surprising how many people are just kind of, oh, yeah, put it away in the cupboard and forget about it. I went to a friend's house the other day and she was like, I haven't eaten with you guys since 2022, but I've got a stash of 6 dabbers in the basement. I was like, what?
Who was it? Name and shame them.
She's the head of the PTA.
And sometimes, you know, I'll just come back, you know, from work or in the weekend from doing something with my kids and I'll see like 3 dabbers on my doorstep. People still just sort of think that it operates out of our home and I'll always have dabbers off.
Yeah. Although I guess it's still welcome.
We'll take them back.
But yeah, it's funny.
That's so funny. Because they're quite an appealing thing as well, aren't they? I can imagine people being like,
Useful. They really are. You know, in the summertime, they're great for picnics in the park or, you know, just keeping trinkets in them or taking them to the, you know, bulk food store to fill them up with, you know,
grains and things. Berry picking. Somebody sent us pictures, didn't they?
Yeah, berry picking, or you can even bake in them. You know, you can bake cakes and brownies and things. So, yeah, they're really handy.
Yeah, so people should buy their own because they're very great, but they should return yours.
Yeah, absolutely. Or just sign up and eat with us.
Abel and Cole anticipated this potential problem when looking at their refillable packaging and designed their systems accordingly.
We have kind of explicitly tried to design the pots to not be attractive, which is...
like aeroplane blankets. You don't want to steal them. They're all brown.
You know what? I quite like the aeroplane blankets, actually. So that was,
wow, there you go.
Not the greatest example. Work, yeah. I have a few. But basically, is you know, it's just meant to be a purely utilitarian object. And it could have anything in it as well. That's kind of one of the important things when you're sort of designing these schemes. So our refill proposition works on the basis that the pots are standardized in terms of material and they're standardized to 3 sizes, so small, medium, large.
Right.
And then they can then be used to fill 200 grams of peanuts, or actually we don't do peanuts because that's a very high allergen risk, but 200 grams of walnuts, or you know, 500 grams or 1 kilo of porridge oats, those kinds of things. And because they are interchangeable, that's what makes it, or part of what makes it, an affordable scheme.
Recently, at the Museum of Brands, Alice Kane and her team worked with the University of Sheffield and their project Many Happy Returns to curate a display called Reuse, Refill, Rethink. And one of the examples they pulled out from the archive to include also created this appealing packaging dilemma for its retailer.
So one of them is this beautiful Haagen-Dazs refillable container. It is gorgeous. It is like a beautiful aluminium, double-walled, like strawberry Haagen-Dazs embossed. You know, it's I want one. But that's been part of the problem with that container, is that
people don't want to give them back, and
they're not going to put them back into the system where you might not get that back, or if you do get it back, it might not be as perfect, or, you know.
Yeah.
So people have held on to them, and that's, again, it's broken the chain.
Yeah.
So that's why I think you also see things looking a bit more like kind of utilitarian. So I guess one of the other things which has been quite an interesting part of this is looking at other countries and the fact that in other countries these systems are really actually very active and currently, particularly Germany, I think our examples are within Germany, Mexico, and Denmark. Mm. In Mexico, they basically, Coca-Cola reuse almost all of their bottles.
Wow. So it is possible.
It is absolutely
possible.
They
just have to be forced to do it.
You just have to have a different, we have to have the system set up by the brand, and people just have to be willing to say, oh, that's how we do it.
Yeah, because Coca-Cola, they're one of the examples that get, you know, they make something, it's like a mind-blowing amount of bottles a day or something. It's something, thousands and thousands and thousands of plastic bottles every day are produced by Coca-Cola. So the fact that it is possible to create a system where they reuse them is so striking. I need to interrupt myself here to give a depressing insight into the exact Coca-Cola stats. From Greenpeace, in 2021, Coca-Cola had approximately 4 billion refillable plastic bottles and 25 billion refillable glass bottles in circulation. These numbers have remained virtually unchanged, despite its pledge to increase refill and reuse by 25% by 2030, while the company has increased its production of single-use bottles by over 9 billion, from 125 billion in 2021 to 134 billion in 2022.
And also in the case, we look specifically at German brewing, so the German beer industry, and that these bottles they're actually kind of a part of the culture of the drinking of this particular beer. So they have a very strong regional connection. Mm. So the shape, the label, all of that is really embedded within the system of drinking it and participating in that culture.
Mm.
So again, it's this sort of like looking at the behavior, people's behavior and their relationship to a product, and then they're much more willing or just basically much more understanding of the fact that it is a circular system, and you will give that bottle back to that brewery.
Mm-hmm.
But again, that system's in place. That system exists. The breweries are used to it. It's the way that it's always been done.
Yeah.
And it's a very regional thing as well. So we were talking about
kind
like
of
a smaller system, like, you know, taking the milk from a very local dairy.
Yeah.
Or Corona with that example. So again, it's like, it's saying that sometimes these smaller systems are much more easy to set up and put in place, obviously, than like, you know, large scale stuff.
Something else that came up in multiple conversations that I had was the idea of looking outside of how the UK currently manages its packaging to what different countries are doing. I first contacted Shohuni Banerjee when I read that she was producing completely unbranded condiments, and she told me about her real inspiration for how food can be sold.
There's a concept of this, it's like a corner shop in Kolkata where I come from. It is... they're called mudir dokan. So dokan means shop, and mudi means a person who provides like necessities. So these shops, they're in every single neighborhood, minimum like 15 steps from your house or something. There's so many of them, and they stock all your necessities, but they kind of give it to you in your containers or plates or bowls or whatever. So you can go and ask for lentils or rice, and there's a person who sits at the front of the shop, everything's behind them, and you ask them for what you need. And it is a basics shop, so you can't get fancy things. But you can get, you know, like your eggs, your rice, your lentils, your beans, maybe butter, oils, and like some snacks, and that's about it. But they don't have any packaging. There's no branding on anything. And they're the old school shops in Kolkata, where I come from. Actually, a lot of India as well. And they're kind of dying out at the moment because of supermarkets, which I find so sad because those shops are so useful.
Yeah.
And you're not actually having to browse. You just go tell the man, you know, I need, you know, a bowl of lentils for the next week.
Yeah.
And he just gives you a bowl of lentils, and you bring the bowl back, or you bring your own bowl from your house. And I've always found, like, my grandma has only ever shopped from one of these shops. So I've always found it very fascinating how that works, but sadly it's kind of dying out. But I do hope it has a bit of a resurgence with like the slightly, you know, climate friendly situation, because it is, there's no plastic used in these shops.
And Anshu was inspired by food delivery in India to use the particular containers they use at Dabba Drop.
I grew up in Mumbai, which is where the Dabbawala system, I suppose, originates. It's been going for over a century and it's sort of kept the city fed for all of this time. So we looked at that system, you know, an ancient system, and we thought, how could we bring it to London and how could we modernize it for modern day Londoners?
When I first started thinking about these conversations about packaging, I couldn't get away from the emotional connection we have to the design and shape of many of them. I'm sure I'm not the only one who's lost hours of their life on the Sainsbury's archive, wishing our frozen pea packaging these days was half as aesthetic. After meeting Hugo at Able & Cole, I thought a lot about milk and ended up finally finding a milk bottle from my old family dairy, long sold off before I was born, and now display it happily on my windowsill, even though it's been decades since I've bought milk in a glass bottle. I even wrote an entire essay about the Muller Corner and its bespoke pots, which paid subscribers can enjoy, on Substack and Patreon. As the Museum of Brands shows, it's an emotive and deeply informative way of examining and reflecting on our food system. But I did have to wonder what our future might be like when it comes to branded produce. Shohini had an outlook towards this that I admired a lot.
I don't even need my name, my face in people's kitchens. I just want them to remember the taste. That's the main thing for me. So I kind of went down the route of just sterilizing old jars that I use. I have so many jars in my kitchen all the time. Like, I have bags full of jars. And now my friends give me their empty jars, which is great. So I just fill those up, like sterilize them, seal them, and that's it.
I wanted to end this episode with a note from Alice. At one point during our conversation, I commented that I really appreciated her optimism. She had a lot of energy in talking about the museum's work with the University of Sheffield in highlighting the importance of changing the way we think about packaging. And I found it really inspiring and I felt quite energised by it. And it generally made me feel a lot more positive about the overwhelming nature of what needs to change than I normally do.
I think I can have a tendency to be very catastrophizing about it, but it's really nice to hear that message. It feels important.
I feel really, really positive about it, partly having worked with the university and seeing what they are doing.
Yeah, the change.
They've got the theory behind it. They've got the massive amount of like, you know, knowledge and practical, like creating new materials, researching them, really extremely good way of thinking about what the future can look like.
Yeah.
And then actually then doing it.
Yeah. Right? So
just witnessing the fact that this has been a really big project and being able to showcase their project and their work here, that's been a real privilege for me.
Yeah.
And yeah, I would say that, you know, I am positive in parts because change is possible. It needs to be led change. Mm. It needs people to be led in the correct way to make those changes happen. One of the things that was really stark in our conversations when we were discussing some of the things to put in the case was thinking about actually why are some of these systems gone? When they worked so well, these systems, you know, people participated in them, particularly in terms of like thinking about milk delivery. Mm. And it was a really, really closed, secure system. Mm. And the things that we've lost because these systems have been eroded. And it's not the responsibility necessarily of an individual to try and replace these systems. As individuals, we can't. We need larger corporations, brands, and the government to step up and put some of this stuff back into place with legislation, with making things responsible. Mm. And guess what? I'm sure people's individual personal behaviours would shift right back into using these systems. Again, like we've seen through the time tunnel, people being told different things at different times on packaging. You know, people's behaviours aren't set in stone. People are doing a lot of this stuff anyway within their own homes. And so it's just
taking that idea of who is responsible for this out of our own ideas of like, oh, it's my fault, you know, and saying, actually, no, we need other people to step in and make sure that, you know, a greener world is possible, but we need a larger change for that to really happen.
Lekker is written and produced by me, Lucy Dearlove. Thanks to everyone who talked to me about packaging. Hugo and Holly at Abel and Cole, Anshu and Renee at Dabba Drop, Shahini Banerjee of the Supper Club Smoke and Lime, and Alice Kane at the Museum of Brands. You can find out more about all of them via the links in the show notes, and I'll be posting about each of their approach to packaging on the Lekker Instagram too. And as promised, here is a very special treat for Lekker listeners. Anshu and Renee have given me a code to get 50% off your first order with Dabba Drop. Enter Lekker50 at checkout. Delivery is available to anyone in London zones 1 to 3. Just make sure you don't keep your Dabba. And I should just say, this isn't sponsored. They just offered to share a code and I thought that would be a really nice thing for people to have. Selflessly, because I can't even order it because I'm not in London zones 1 to 3. A reminder that the full versions of all of these conversations are available to listen for paid subscribers on Substack and Patreon, and these contributions really help me keep the podcast going. Head to the show notes to find out more if you want to support the podcast. Music is by Blue Dot Sessions. Thanks for listening. I'll be back soon.